Die nächsten drei
The next three speakers deserve soon, but not right now. They deserve a big round of applause. Then they are helping the civilian population in one of the most dangerous areas of war. Since February 2024, the Berlin Help Organization CARES is engaged in Gaza. Sebastian Jünemann, Jürgen Gül, and Nick Semke are presenting how such a help organization works, how it's organized, how do you prepare a team, how do you support people in these teams who are ready to engage on the ground, who see all the suffering on the ground that we only see in the news. And they also show how geoinformation systems used for the coordination of such events are helping to help us. I kindly ask all of you here in so large numbers to kindly applaud for our speakers. Enjoy.
Hört man mich?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Stunkt hier, vor 8 Wochen. Komischer
stunkt Pose. Hier. Weird Pose. I feel uncomfortable. You were there yourselves. Don't you know that it started in 1948? Don't you know that this has no justification? Sounds like it. Carlos, please edit this post.
Anne, 2015, vor 10 Wochen.
Anne, 10 weeks ago. Managing misery is also no solution. Why don't you call for Hamas to surrender and to release the Israeli hostages? No, next 38 weeks ago. You're leaving all these people by themselves if you're unable to clearly name those responsible for the attacks. The soldiers of the Zionist states find themselves while blowing up universities, but you can't name it? Yes, and that brings us right to the comment section, and I open the talk. When the comment sections were burning 11 months deployment in Gaza, my name is Annalea von Karnus. CARES is a health organization which was founded 10 years ago in Berlin. They do medical and social deployments in crisis centers and is currently in Ukraine and in Gaza. With me up here sit Nick, who is also very experienced in humanitarian aid for Sea-Watch, for example, and established the IT team there and led it, and was also deployed for CARES in Ukraine and Gaza. And on my other side is sitting Zep, which was one of the co-founders 10 years ago and is currently co-CEO of CARES and was our first deployment lead in our first mission in February in Gaza. A little bit of content note. We're going to show images of realistic injuries with blood, but we don't show real injuries, just as a head-up notice. We also don't show any patients from Gaza, no faces, but maybe you see a leg or an arm or something, but without injuries. That as an introduction. So after the indescribable attack of Hamas, which left thousands dead and several hundred hostages from Israel as a consequence, we as a humanitarian aid organization, it was clear to us that Israel is not going to leave this unanswered, and that as a humanitarian aid organization, and we already knew who was going to be the people who suffer when the civil society. And last year we were at the CCC and were not really clear whether we were going to be deployed there. We made a workshop there, maybe some of you were here. And we brainstormed together how a deployment in Gaza might look like in a very special kind of place which hadn't existed in that form before. And about a week before that, Zep, I'm looking at you, it was kind of clear that we are going directly in February to Gaza. Could you tell us about this 1 month that we had to prepare for the most challenging deployment that we had so far.
Ja, gerne.
Yes, sure. As you said in the introduction, it has been 10 years that we are already in crisis areas. This one has been a very special one, so you have to look at the context, which are not really irrelevant. So in all other war areas, it was not so confined, constricted, and people cannot escape from the war. You usually have a front zone, there you fight. They also have a lot of people who don't go away, who don't leave. They don't want to leave the villages, like in Ukraine. But usually there are other areas where you can escape too. In Gaza, it was quickly clear that the frontiers had been closed. Not only this made it very special, but also even just to get there, we didn't go there by ourselves, but we have been requested by the World Health Organization. So we were monitoring this, and we said we could imagine going there and decided to do this. And then when the deployment drew closer, so between the CCC Congress last year and the February date, a lot of things came up that we had to deal with. For example, that we as helping people could not easily enter and leave. We could just enter, we were in there, and even if something happened, even if we got a heart attack, or if people are going to have psychological problems, it's going to take 10 days to leave that area, because there's no frontier where you could just go to and say, here, I'm going to leave now. Those were things that we never had before. War zones are always demanding from the logistics, but in an area where we barely got anything in, where there are barely any humanitarian aid deployments or shipments, we had to prepare specifically down to the pocket knives that each team member received. Our entire material, we had to bring that there, and we had to take that on foot. All of them had to enter via Egypt, over Rafah, the border entry point. Everything had to be delivered on foot. That was completely new for us. We never had that before. That you really fail on a border, so you couldn't, as if you would go into an airplane and have to transmit everything physically from one side to the other. So we prepared thoroughly, completely self-impactful. So it's usually preconditioned by the World Health Organization that you have to be completely autonomous. You cannot impose yourself onto the country that you're going to. So, but in this case, it was clear that in Gaza, in this quasi-state structure, we cannot impose ourselves or demand something from that. So we brought a lot of food, toilet paper, everything. We really had to import everything. The first crew were just 5 people. Annalena can say a little bit more about that, about the preparation, talking about the crew, the assessment crew that first goes there to see how's the situation on site, what's coming up. They already knew themselves from other war zones or conflict areas. That takes a lot of stress out of the situation. But that was also the point of the preparation, right, that you really have an idea of, you go into a country with a statement, you will see terrible things, and even if it is like that, 7 to 10 days, you cannot change anything. Yes, you just said that besides all the equipment that you just mentioned that we had to think about bringing, we also had to think about how we would prepare our teams for this very special deployment. And in Cardos, we prepared roughly 1 year ago to have hostile environment awareness trainings, and served us. What served us were live action role play elements. We simulate a deployment. So that was going for 24/3 or 24/4 hours and days to prepare the teams maximally well, so as well as in the live deployment. So in the last 11 months, we did about 15 trainings, and all of those has been fed by the feedback that we got from the team on site in Gaza, where we exchanged information. So we dealt with technical and medicinal topics, where the people have been on site. We had scenarios where, with a lot of supporters, we played those scenarios, mask injuries. The water is stale and people get diarrhea. So to be as close as possible to reality. And to prepare the people to the best of our abilities. We paid a lot of attention to psychological preparation and post-treatment and briefings, independent from the heat, where we had psychological preparation and post-therapy. Acardus has its own pool of therapists, which are very reachable for the volunteers, but our community friends from Sea-Watch also had a great database of psychosocial supporters, over which we could also request aid or assistance anonymously. So that all the volunteers could actually participate in that. It's very low barrier. You don't really have to say your name. So it's a really nice offer. So people know that there is some support even after the deployment.
And one other point is that in something different, you really can't underestimate the dynamics of a group. The group dynamics of people who get to know each other on the way to the deployment or just meet on this place of deployment. It's really surprising what kind of conflicts can happen when outside there's a lot of conflict going on. Such happens in fast, quicker, and dynamics develop quicker. So in trainings we try to stress that and talk about that and sometimes be a bit mean in trying to fasten or quicken dynamics development. But it's really important because that's something that happens in every kind of deployment. People just might not get along and some things self-develop themselves. So at CADUS we're very much briefed to offer support from outside and to mediate and to moderate and try to support from the outside and the inside if there's stress going on. So we tried with our first team where he was his lead is to prepare with as much as we knew from foreign deployments. We had these trainings and initiated them. We packed, we prepared, we read a lot and prepared as good as possible. But, well, question is, can you even prepare for what's going to happen? And I can really remember a very emotional goodbye at the departure. So the first crew going to Gaza, who had 800 kg of luggage in their cars and drove the cars to Switzerland and then took the plane to Cairo. Do you want to tell how was getting that arrival and passing the border? Yeah, you just said that it's very emotional. That was one of the points. The conflict was very, very high tension already. So it's a very different story compared to going to Ukraine, where it is very, very difficult to weigh them against each other. So the people going to Ukraine are not longer taking the largest load on them. Of course, it was not difficult to go to Switzerland and passing the border. And all the logistic questions, how can we take 800 kg with five people to Switzerland and then well, going via the airport in Berlin, it's difficult to pay all that because we only have funds from donations, so we need support from other organizations. So we went to Switzerland, or drove to Switzerland, and of course 800 kg and 50 luggage. And then you arrive at Cairo, which is a very, very lively and absolutely touristy city. Even before you arrive there and go to the deployment, it's very difficult to stir all that and organize all that. So we arrive there, and then we need to find taxis who can take along 800 kg. So for 1 and 2 days, we've been moving all the luggage, and we've been prepared by the WHO and the UN. And then we were taken in a convoy to the border, to Gaza. This was the first and the only opening of the border where I was able to enter, where on the Egyptian side, the Egyptian military was positioned, and the other side, there were already staff of this Palestinian self-organization. Of course, there's no Israeli military, only Egyptians who supervise everything in the name of Israel to check the luggage, to prevent the entering of unwanted goods. And it's very annoying to be at the border and you know that 1 kilometer from you there's shooting going on. You have to wait and see what's going to happen. And so going back to the question, can you prepare for such a deployment? No, in the beginning not, because you just can't go to booking.com and book an hotel. That's not possible in areas of war. So we just knew there's a curfew in the evening, but still you arrive only at the evening, because that's not possible in the other way with all of your luggage. You're just 5 people and so much luggage, and on the Palestinian side, you're standing there on the other side of the border and you don't know how to get on. So how about the first days? So in the first days, we were able to find a spot to stay. So you had to find connection to local people, and there are always questions going on. How do we prevent? What's going on? So everything that happens in the background. Now you're standing at the border and you try to make contacts beforehand, maybe via exiled Palestinians who you trust and you know of that they're not working together with Hamas, but still you're standing at Rafah and you know that any time there could be rockets hitting you and you haven't slept. So this is the first accommodation we had. You can see this is very much an unfinished construction, where we try to move in some ways. In the winter, it's cold even in Gaza. So during the first days, we try to orientate ourselves, meeting the WHO, who were the coordinating unit, and told us we can go there and there, be positioned there and there. So in the first day, it was just moving from A to B, which is also sort of an emotional input because, you know, the people are really suffering and there's a lot to do, but the first days, you need to organize yourself. So here in the background, you can see all the boxes and reorganizing all the boxes, the 800 kg, and repacking them in a sensible way. And then we were quickly moved towards our first base of deployment, a European hospital. Like I said, we are not using any splatter pictures, just a glimpse of what is going on the ground, what did you see. So this is a picture of the hospital site. And normally where there should be ambulances parked, there's just one tent after the other. So in Rafah you can prepare, but you can't prepare for much and most, and you can't prepare for the pictures you will see. Of course, we know refugee camps, and we know how refugees are accommodated, how people look like when they're suffering, but seeing all of this so compressed in a city where several hundred thousand people who are trying to find protection in any other way, especially in hospitals, where we could trust in February they wouldn't be bombed. So everybody was trying to camp in the hospitals and in the hallways, in the corridors, on the right and left sides, there were curtains and people were sleeping behind us. The whole family is living there while we were treating patients on the other side of the curtains. And of course, people were dying there. So we were quickly getting into action there. The specialty of CARDIS is emergency medicine and intense medicine, stabilizing cases. So we took over the emergency room there. And what Andrea said beforehand, that the people affected the most are those who are less able to defend themselves. So when people say we're only treating combatants, no, we're treating the young, the old, those who suffer the most likely in case of such conflicts. Sepp, you also, as one of the first people for Germany, reported from Gaza to Germany for ZDF or something like this, and you were interviewed live. Which difficulties did you face when reporting from Gaza? Which were the obstacles you were confronted with? I think I have two absolutely stupid pictures. I know this looks stupid, but wait for the next one. So, you were taken out of the shift where you have to say, of course, things happened we couldn't prepare for. The emergency rooms were so stuffed, our teams were ripped apart, and we didn't see each other until the end of the shift. And for 1 or 2 days, we were unable to coordinate each other because, as experts, we were immediately brought to patients to treat them, and I was pulled out of one of such a shift and put in front of a camera. And you look absolutely dazzled into a blinding light, and you've got a headset in your ear, and you've got a German moderator, and it's been warned that it was going to be a short interview, and I'll be definitely asked if I've seen a tunnel. And you can look at me, I've been in Gaza for 3 days and I have been treating 50 patients. I had a difficult day, and you're standing in front of a camera and the thing they are asking you is, have you seen the tunnels? And if I had been prepared to that by a good friend, then I wouldn't have known how to react to this. And even though I was prepared, I was unsure how to react because it's such a stupid question. I mean, that is just, it's a landscape. There's several 40 kilometers, and who thinks that the first thing that we do in coming there is look at it and say, that's how Hamas go, and of course we didn't see tunnels. And of course I can't put myself in front of a German TV camera and say, no, there aren't any tunnels. I just saw this little bit of Gaza. So what really much of surprise was that after this first interview, there was a really rush of press, and they pulled me through all the broadcasting channels, and all of them sort of ask the same questions. The same thing. How hard is it? How horrible things do you see every day? And how did you see the tunnels? And that's the same thing I've been seeing for weeks, once and again in the media, asking the same questions. Yeah, so coming back to our comment section, and on our comment sections, we had reactions. Both sides don't protect the civilians. Only one side throws bombs and bombs houses with sleeping civilians in them. And this one, DJ Sirius News X, ceasefire, are you serious? That means to give us strength and then to continue. Stop the killing of civilians, the destruction of a population. Are you aware that you need 25 years to bury all the children in Gaza that were brutally killed if you would bury one per day? That is 1/3 of the lifetime of the average of humanity. So many children and even more civilians were murdered. Ceasefire, that's inhumane. And what do you have to say that the carnival in Düsseldorf was misinterpreted and is joked upon? Yeah, those are examples we faced to show what we were confronted with. And one part we're not surprised by that, because Gaza and Israel, that is a very topic of a lot of tension, but at the same time we were surprised with how much a sort of projection CADUS turned into short time. And for short time we had a minimal consensus that you could decide on CADUS, and CADUS was only helping civilians, and that's okay, but that quickly changed. And that also did something with us in the back office and as an organization. We were put in front of special demands and special requests to our recording and our media. and doing has to do political statements. But that's not our task as a humanitarian organization. And that also happened in the way how we reported from on-site deployments, and they're always putting in the borders of, no, this is our work, and we're doing it quite well. And that's what we're faced with and have a challenge with. And that's a challenge, especially for crewing. And you need a special type of person for these kinds of deployments, and special kind of people only volunteer for these deployments. And it's very important to look at the backgrounds of people. And if you want to look at the specialty of crewing.
Okay, let's say this up front. We're not trying to complain here. We're not saying that crewing is that hard or staffing is that hard. We just want to emphasize that when doing the crewing, there was a need to ask the question that if you want to partake in a deployment like that, if someone who has just been fighting falls in front of your feet and who's dying, would you treat them irrespective of which side they fought for? And some people will say if it's an Israeli or a Palestinian, then no. And for us, that's clearly a reason not to put you there. You're not aligned with our goals of impartiality. For other deployments that we did, we didn't have that issue, really. We had the issue before that people wanted to only help a certain side of a certain conflict, and that's not aligned with us. But we're not the judges. We're not there to decide what's going to happen and which side is going to win. We need to make sure that the people are there for humanitarian reasons, and that the fire really got stoked when we needed to check the social media of people who volunteered for us, mainly because it is a security risk for our crew that if the Israeli forces find that out about people partaking in the deployment, that they wouldn't let us enter or leave the whole group if they found one of them putting stuff out on social media. And really, this shouldn't be anything we need to deal with. But then we're being the whole group is being held hostage for in a literary sense for the actions of a single person. So it highlights the needs for us to stay clear of taking sides and having people that take sides. And we definitely need to sort this out with the people who volunteer for us for deployments, even going into their family history, like back three generations, in order to... Because Israel basically said that if you have Palestinian relatives up to 3 degrees back in your heritage, then they would consider you partial, and we needed to communicate that to our team and via our social media, which also makes us look biased. But that's why we have... let me just show you a couple more postings. We were forced, or we felt forced, to post what the humanitarian... Well, the basis that we work on is, what are our principles, in order to explain to people what is our task, what is our goal, our mission. And we wanted to make clear that these are the principles that we are bound by as a humanitarian organization. And coming back to the comments section, so these are reactions to news reports about everyday happenings in Gaza, about evacuations and locals on the ground in Gaza that worked for us, and how they perceive the situation as it's happening. And then we get posts that say, terrible again from Kados, all that direct witnessing, and this is how you frame what your Palestinian colleagues, what your volunteers have seen and endured for 365 days and 76 years. Unconscionable.
Or
Cozy Cat Illustration. who actually, we have a few people that we already know the name of, and that are basically jumping on every train that they can find with that topic. And she's talking about this is under a section where someone of us who was part of the war reported, and she was commenting, she says, the war began, but she doesn't say why and who's responsible. She doesn't even say that medical worker were involved in the hostage taking. Very impartial. And then there's Yasmin, who says, they're Germans, they can't say anything against Israel, but it's very interesting how they use the narrative, even though they know better. You get used to it after a while, you know? We already knew that what we could expect from certain users online, and but there's also a trend that we can see in there. There was definitely, it got worse over time, and the war basically, yeah, expanded. The situation got worse and deteriorated. And now to hand over to Nick, who left for deployment 6 months after his colleague, and he already got the impressions from us what is happening, and he already has all the background that we told him, and he had completely different conditions that he found. For example, you went via Jordan and not via Egypt, and we tried our best to prepare you, but how was your arrival there? How was the how were you received? So as for the preparation, when I was talking to the crewing, it started with a few emails that I got from you. It explained the situation. It got darker over time. There was less and less information that we received. And the last that I remember before leaving was that you should have very little cash on you if you enter, a maximum of 2 kilos of food, at most 300 grams of tobacco, no technology, no extra phones, no antennas, no notebooks, nothing. Everything that looks technologically or that helps with logistics, it gets very complicated quickly when trying to enter the country. And then you enter Jordan, where you get more briefings by the UN, the United Nations, and you could already tell that they were quite competent. A lot of people with a lot of experience, but they were clearly overwhelmed and in over the heads. It's just the external conditions were so bad. Like when you arrive and you only have 2 kilos of food, and you obviously share it around in the team, and you need to carry more stuff that they asked for, just supplies, and you're asking stuff like, is this about is this net weight or is this brutal weight? And the question is, am I going to push the limit in order to maximize the gain, or will that happen and I have to then drop everything? Or so this is where I quickly started to see that the conditions were different than anything that I knew beforehand. And I started from Amman. I drove through the West Bank, where we crossed the border. And this is where we had the first contacts with the Israeli army. And it was kind of strange because also people from different backgrounds in there, like Palestinians that you could see from the clothes. And then you had the first contacts with, they were really like human contacts, you know, human interaction. You're not trying to yell at each other, but they actually helped to carry stuff. And it was kind of strange, unexpected. And then we started, can you show me the last picture again? This is Kerem Shalom. This is, you cross the West Bank with the convoy, and then you move along Israel, and then you get close to the site where the attacks of the 7th of October happened, and there's the Kibbutz Gerim, where it happened, and you just go through there, and then you get to Kerem Shalom. That's the border crossing on the Israeli side, and then it's similar to what happened in Rafah, but it wasn't possible for us anymore. basically the border between Egypt and Palestine was closed, so we had to cross through Israel. This is what you see here. These are the armored vehicles of the United Nations. And there were already things like, if a Westerner, you get food and otherwise you don't. And you immediately see the area where the plunderings happened. There was a lot of looting by the convoys. And you move through the destroyed Rafah and other destroyed areas and villages, maybe the map now. So you're going to the center of the Gaza Strip. The north of Gaza, that's the area where the attacks have happened. The center is, if you see the mouse, this is where this is Erbala. This is relatively untouched. Relative. You definitely see destruction there, but there are definitely streets where you haven't had bombings, for example. But every ruin is still inhabited. The situation with water and sanitation is obviously horrible. But then you go to Rafah, which is destroyed much more. And then you arrive at the guest house of the UN. It looks like an oasis, really. There's actually a sea of UN vehicles in front. And then we moved into the Qadis house. And what you see there, imagine a villa that is being inhabited by 10 hippies that actually live on the roof because it's too warm inside. And but they live in that villa because it makes sense to have a fenced-in area. And on the roof, they have a big sign that says Qadis, just in the hopes that this stops them bombing it. And this is something you can't prepare for. On the one hand, it's a lot less warlike than I imagined, but then also much more than I ever imagined. So it's already the whole war has been going on for a year. There's a lot of routine there, especially the people who have been there for a long time, and also those that live there. They're just numbed, you know, to the situation. And this was a little surprising to me when you arrive there. And yeah, there's kind of it's almost like Christmas when someone arrives, because whatever you bring is going to be distributed among the team. And this is kind of nice. This is I found this really cool of Qadis. We clearly work together with people that live on the ground, that are from there, local fixers, doctors. There's no difference being made between the foreigners and the locals. Some things you cannot do, but obviously we try to treat everyone the same as much as we can. And there's, other than the legal reasons, there are no real differences between the locals and the remote people.
This is like what Carl Yunus looks like. So the contrast is happening a lot. Where you have a lot of destruction and SpongeBob graffiti right in the middle. And this impression was something that was relatively surprising. A lot of destruction and a lot of instruments of normality, minimal normality. Then how you can imagine a typical day of deployment, what you hear all the time in all of Gaza, drones all the time, a lot of buzzing, sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't. You also have continuous fire, machine gun fire and artillery, usually a little bit further away, often a little bit further away, but occasionally also closer. But in the place that I've spent a lot of time in, look at the windows shaking. You are getting used to that, as absurd as it sounds. Talking about the work in the house, I was the technical and acoustics person. I was therefore also responsible to have food and water, count how many pre-prepared meals were still available there, also do office stuff. In the end, you have to do a lot of bureaucratic stuff as an NGO. A lot of sheets have to be filled out, a lot of forms. What IT people are doing a lot, printing. Then one thing I consider particularly important, CARD is also gathers data for the UN or for the WHO. So one of those questions was how plausible are the data that are being provided by the Gaza health insurance system. I can personally say that the numbers I put in are most definitely sure. The hospitals are providing data concerning casualties, how many of those are war-induced. Well, and a lot of those things, if you look at if a butane bottle is being blown up, it's mostly caused by war, and you have a lot of war traumas. And the doctors did that very consciously and meticulously. And I trust those statistics personally, but that's a personal opinion. When we left the house, it was important that you planned and coordinated that in advance. Every movement is provided in advance to the actors. The Israeli army, they provided a web tool. So for a trip that takes about 20 minutes, you have to spend 1 hour entering that into the tool. That was one of my tasks. And also council deployment teams in hospitals. Here you can see one of the hospitals in Canyons, the small hospital, and you can see how the administration was working. I supported them personally in the guest project. I'm going to go into detail on that a little bit later. The windows were all broken. They have been under constant siege by the IDF for several days. And so several of those colleagues that we worked with also died over the course of the time there. And what you can also hear in the debate there, the Palestinian Red Cross, so the Palestinian Half Moon, have been framed as Hamas cabs on the ground. They are usually the first responders. And so if something happens and Hamas people are being injured, and they are allowed to come there. It's the result of that is that the hospital, that the ambulances look like they have been shown in the picture. So based on the very last minute things, spontaneity, one thing that I noticed relatively early was that geodata have been sent via WhatsApp on a regular basis, which you can see on the next slide, which was very important. So what you can see here on the right side, the right picture, are the evacuation zones, which are provided by the Israeli army. They are spread into a lot of different zones. And when they become active as an Israeli army, those zones are being evacuated. And those evacuation zones have been shared via WhatsApp. And all the people who know that they did version management, the problem was that nobody really knew who had the most up-to-date data. Also, depending on the location, data that were active on the phones. Some of the other of my other Sea-Watch colleagues actually built an application that works offline first, so it doesn't need continuous internet access, and is synchronizing the data with other people, so other people can provide those data, other people can log in. And it's being automatically synchronized. I guess I don't have to explain that to this crowd. And this is being tested live now on site on several different convoys. And we are looking for people, because we're doing that free and open source, so we're looking for people who supported us in that. So here's the contact data. Thank you, Fanik.
Thanks, Nick, so much, and sorry that you had to rush through this. We've been talking so much. And please send us a message with this email address. Technically, we had the idea of some closing words, but, well, we had to cut it because we wanted to open the room for Q&A. So if it's able for you to just cut off the closing words and go to the Q&A, if it's possible. Yeah, I'll just include that in the Q&A. Okay, so you heard the words, and due to the time, we have to please move to the microphones quickly if you've got questions. And on the way there, please think about how you make the questions as short as possible. Please skip comments. And if you're already moving, I'm asking the signal angel, is anything from the internet that we can put in now? No. Great. And we've got the first person at the microphone. What's your question? Is it working? Yes. How can you afford to go into the deployments? How do you finance yourselves as private persons? Your money. Well, it's not difficult to not tell it. We are financed by the Office of Foreign Affairs for some parts. But it's difficult to start these deployments, planning these deployments and going there. We need your support and donations. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to support of this. Medical deployments are so expensive, and we have too little people. Otherwise, wouldn't be possible. Thank you. We've got another question over there. Do you have a rotation system so they can rotate the teams? And if yes. Is it okay, or do you need a shorter interval? One of the big problems we have in Gaza is that the slots going into Gaza is very, very limited. The UN has a huge problem in getting people inside. We are entering by a UN ticket, and that's minimized for us. So in the beginning, we had 2 weeks of missions. When I came, it was 4 weeks of missions, and that was okay. But now it's 6 weeks. So that's sort of okay-ish, but so it's given to us from external, from outside. I would have preferred shorter weeks, but and what has changed also, we're not sending in whole crews who we prepare at once and then send them in at once, but right now we always exchange two people at once, one or two people who rotate in or rotate out, so the crews only get to know each other on the ground and don't really have time to get to know each other, and then suddenly it's a change, so that changed a lot. Thanks a lot. One more question.
Hi.
At the workshop last year, you wouldn't know if it would be possible to go to Gaza, because you weren't sure if the communication between the teams is secure enough. And back then, it was difficult even for the UN. It wasn't possible for the UN to get satellite phones or other ways of communication. And that was one of the reasons why you couldn't go. How did you solve that issue? Well, from the highest position, we were asked to smuggle goods in. And of course, that's what we did. And we all tried to get smuggled goods in. So satellite phones and others. Well, it's gotten better a bit, but still in your everyday life. And we show it chosen every day. The communication with the team is extremely limited. And that makes it even difficult, of course. Of course, there are hotspots, like in joint humanitarian operation centers, where the UN is located in WHO. And there you also have Wi-Fi that you can use. We also have own Wi-Fi at home, but it's extremely surprisingly slow, and it's not even enough to send over to WhatsApp. But we can communicate with the team. And then one question over there. Hi. My question is regarded towards journalists who are often told that you can't enter with some very, very weird excuses because of sharing tactics of military, etc. Did you have any contacts and touch with IDF and checkpoints where you would be suggested to be working for one unwelcome side? How did it go on during the ongoing operations in Gaza? All the time, from all kinds of sides. All the time, from all sides, you're being accused to work for the other side at the Israeli checkpoints. It's very difficult. It's hardcore. We can't really hide that.
Genau, die Untersuchungen.
The interrogations and the looking into patients. It's very hardcore. Sometimes you're waiting for hours in a checkpoint in a control with a patient. It can also happen in an illegal roadblock. That's something that happens in these areas of war.
Die Hamas hat auch noch.
And the Hamas also has active checkpoints there, so.
Nicht durchgehend besetzt.
They are not always occupied, but still. And then one more question over there.
Was war so eure Erfahrung mit so der Verfügbarkeit?
What was the experience with availability of medical equipment? Did you have to work with what you brought, or what was available at the hospitals? How was the situation with humanitarian aid, you know, medical aid?
Als ich da war.
Well, when I was there, the WHO said that the floors in the hospitals were cleaned with normal water. Everything that's getting in is at its end. Everyday goods, etc. So everything that is brought in is brought in by people, so otherwise it doesn't come in. So I had a 20-liter duffel bag, which was stuff which I didn't know what it was, but well, I guess medical stuff. And one big problem is that in the beginning, a lot of humanitarian aid arrived in the beginning, but it wasn't very coordinated. So the logistic apparatus behind it did not communicate. So it was clear that in Gaza there would be full warehouses, but we didn't know what was available and where and what situation, what status. And that's the same today, I think.
Dann haben wir noch eine letzte Frage.
One last question with the please be quick. You also moved patients outside of Gaza. How did you do that and in what conditions was that permitted? Yeah, we moved patients from north to south Gaza and also we did do international transports, so outside of Gaza, but that's several levels above us. We just executed. That's not done by us, but the WHO and the UN, and coordinated with the conflict parties. It was a condition of the UN for Israel and the Hamas that it had to be made clear which patients, especially extremely harshly injured people or children, that was organized by them, and we just executed. Yeah, and with that, we're at the end of our time. If you have further questions, I'm sure you'll meet all the people on the Congress. And thank them. You can also do this now and thank them for the work of Sebastian, Annalea, and Nick by applauding to them. Thank you.